Hi, it's Dave Sweet, founder and CEO of Focus Core. Thanks for listening to the Focus Core podcast. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the Focus Core 2025 salary guide has been released. We're there with some great insights, not only for information about salaries in Japan, but insights about job market, hiring, and what's important to both companies and individuals looking for a job specifically in Japan. There's a link for that in the show notes. Please take a look. And now on to our program.
DSV wouldn't be who we are today if it wasn't for, mergers and acquisitions. There's a lot of niche players in Japan. If anybody internationally is listening to this podcast, I can tell you there's a lot of private companies in Japan whose, let's say, owners are the second generation, third generation owners, and they don't have anybody to take over the family business. And there's a lot of opportunity in Japan to do, a roll-up of these niche players, whether it's on the trucking transportation side or on the warehousing and distribution side.
So, welcome to the Focus Core podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of introducing Scott Smalley, a seasoned management executive with over 35 years of experience. For the past 25 years, Scott has dedicated himself to global logistics in Japan. He is currently serves as the managing director and president of DSV Solutions in Japan, one of the global leaders in logistics. Scott's career is a testament to his strategic sales and operational expertise in global supply chain management and logistics. As a bilingual and multicultural professional, he brings a deep understanding of managing global operations. And with a strong entrepreneurial spirit, Scott has continuously designed innovative supply chain products and services while leading successful implementations. Beyond his professional achievements, Scott is passionate about coaching and developing business teams, helping them achieve extraordinary results. He's highly respected within the logistics industry and among multinational management professionals worldwide. Scott values the lifelong friendships and cherished relationships he has built with individuals from diverse cultures, both in his business and private travels. And I can attest to that. I've known Scott for several years. So join us as we delve into Scott's extensive experience in general management, business development, supply chain management, freight forwarding, and customer relationship management. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, David. That's a really interesting individual that you just announced there. And I wish I was as interesting as that introduction comes across.
I think you're more interesting, Scott. So let's start
I'd
with
be more interesting if I could play the ukulele. Let's put it that way. Still trying to get up to your level.
There you go. Well, I got an extra one. We'll put that on at the end here. Let's start about let's how what brought you to Japan? Let's start there.
Just a desire to leave mid-Michigan, where I was born and raised. When I was growing up, I was able to spend summers in California, always coming back to Michigan for the school year and thinking to myself, oh my God, the world is a much larger place than, cornfields and automotive factories. And when I had my first opportunity, my second year in college, to join a group of students traveling to Japan, I went for it, and it kind of changed the trajectory of my life. So, like many people, I think that have come here from abroad, we might have fallen into it and then just kind of fell in love with the country and the people and the culture, and the rest is history. Yeah.
And then talk around, jumping into business in Japan. How did that occur?
Similarly, I had met someone on that program that I originally brought me to Japan, who had graduated from university by that time and had worked for a Japanese automotive supplier in Tokyo. And after, I think, 2 or 3 years, he moved back to the States. And he was approached by someone who wanted him to move back to Japan. And he said, I'm not really interested in living in Japan again. But here's my friend Scott, who is probably interested. And sure enough, that kind of brought me back to Japan more permanently in a career of logistics, which although I'd graduated from Michigan State, which has a tremendous logistics department, I did not study logistics in college. It's more social science, anthropology, economics. But I think that really prepared me to be inquisitive and explorative and open to new experiences. And the field of logistics was really just up and coming at the time. There were not a lot of foreign companies directly running their business in Japan. Mm-hmm. So it was really an opportunity for someone that put me into a career that was very specialized, in particularly specialized because not only logistics was a specialization, but also being bilingual and willing to work in the Japanese market has really, I think, allowed me to be in a niche market, in a niche role. I think it served me very well. Really enjoyed the career.
That's great, because I think it's logistics is such a interesting world to have fallen into in Japan. And you must have seen so many changes. What really surprised you when you joined into the industry?
I think, in my role, and I think a lot of leaders globally in logistics, we try to appeal to younger audiences how to bring people into our industry, because it's still very, I think, driven by kind of that old world freight forwarding, the freight business, the movement of goods. And I really try to appeal to young people. It's not really a sexy business from the outside when you look at it. But once you get into the business and you start meeting people from all over the world, all different backgrounds and cultures, and then you start to work with a range of products, really exciting products. And early in my career, I decided, why would I want to go after a business of like industrial products, maybe plastics or aluminum or steel or just something that's not particularly sexy? I'm going to go after the Ducatis, right? I'm going to go after the Giorgio Armanis. I'm going to go after, the Nikes of the world, and those products that appeal to me, that their business is interesting. And so I've been able to work with some really cool brands, really cool companies, that if I was working for one company, I would only be doing their products day in and day out. And that didn't really appeal to me. And so being able to work with companies like Louis Vuitton in Japan, or BMW, or Ducati, they're a current customer of DSV's, Estee Lauder, the cosmetics industry and such. I'm getting invited to family sales and opportunities to buy their products has really been a lot of fun. And as you mentioned in my introduction, I can go, and my wife can attest, I can go any place in the world, and I probably know somebody that's near that city or where I'm going, and I'll reach out to them and I'll say, hey, it's been 5 years or whatever, how you doing? Let's get together. And it's just a really wonderful way to have a reward for the work and the effort that we put in, right, is to develop those friendships and those relationships in any corner of the globe. So
brilliant. Yeah, I just think, recruitment is, again, similar to yours, a consulting business, and being able to see, I recommend a consulting business for anyone freshly out of school, to be able to jump in for 3 to 5 years and see all the different businesses and the different models and the different personalities, and then either go in house or continue on that consulting path in some sort of services. I find that one of the most wonderful things that a student who's entering work could do. And so I highly recommend your industry or any consulting industry. It's brilliant.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, you're a foreigner, you're working in a foreign company back in the day. To my mind, Japan transportation industry is very domestic. It's dominated by big players. And traditionally it was back in the day as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work for you coming in as kind of a foreigner, the younger Scott coming mm-hmm. in and working? What was that like?
You know, I'm looking back, and I tell this to my kids all the time. I don't know how we survived. You know, we just had guts. You know, I just kind of feel that, and I don't want to, you know, diss the younger generation. They got the world at their fingertips, right? Yeah. We had to look stuff up. You know, we had to really hustle to find opportunities and to be introduced. So, you know, obviously, my Japanese wasn't that great when I first came to Japan. And the American Chamber of Commerce was really a place where I could meet other foreign executives who we had that common language, English, that we could speak with each other. And I kind of also, you know, the ability to connect with people is really important in our industry in that consulting field, right? And so I made it a point to go through the American Chamber of Commerce directory. Remember, we had hundreds and hundreds of pages we could flip through. And I looked up Michigan companies where I was from in order to connect with whoever was with this company and say, hey, I'm from Michigan too. You need help with your logistics. So, you know, there's Herman Miller, there's Steelcase, obviously the automotive companies, General Motors, Ford, et cetera, Whirlpool, Dow, you know, there's hundreds of them. So that was kind of my corner that I worked in. But I also connected with other young professionals, and we actually created a group. We called it the 601 or 701 Club, and we were each professionals in our own fields, and we would introduce mutual customers to each other. So, you know, we had the office guy, we had the office furniture fit out guy, I was the logistics guy, and then we had the office plant guy, you know, and we, I think we had 10 guys, and we would meet for lunch once a month. We meet for poker once every other month. We would cross introduce potential customers, and it was quite effective back then. Right.
So any young people that are listening to this podcast, if you want an exercise in sales and how to get started and be effective, Scott has just told you sales 101, how to be effective. That's a brilliant summary. I mean, you go and you make connections with people that you have something in common with, and mm-hmm. then build that up into your own little tribe, what we call it now, which mm-hmm. usually, and you cross-pollinate and you do that kind of partner sales, helping each other out. It's, yeah.
Well, we always looked at it as, okay, I've got two sets of ears, two sets of eyes. You know, it takes me hours to go through a directory. It takes me hours to call companies.
Yep.
But if I can meet with a group of guys in one afternoon, have lunch, and they can introduce me to six new customers, you know, it pays off. And and again, if there isn't something there that can help you or support you in your career, then create it yourself, right? And I think today it's so much easier than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, create your Instagram page or your Facebook page or whatever TikTok's happening these days. So, and find people with similar likes and aspirations. So,
absolutely. So let's, I mean, transportation is such a cool industry. Now you're doing a lot with kind of both domestic and global markets. You know, talk a little bit around that and how you you mix that with
your so domestic strategy. The domestic logistics market, it really hasn't changed a lot in 30 years. I mean, trucks are still trucks, and to tell you the truth, the prices haven't really gone up all that much. I've been shocked at you know, and obviously in your industry you understand this as well. I mean, neither is salaries. But again, you know, we can get a, you know, 1,000 yen teishoku, whereas that same meal in the U.S. would cost $30 easy, you know, with tip. So there's the pluses and minuses that go along doing business in Japan. But I think the biggest change that I see in our industry right now is the challenge with labor and finding labor for our operations. As you know, probably very similar to the service industry, restaurants and convenience stores and such. We don't have a real highly educated workforce like warehousing. You know, we have to find bodies, people that can move boxes typically. And that's becoming more and more challenging. And the costs for that labor is increasing, in particular the last 2 or 3 years. So automation is becoming very important, if not necessary to win business. I think in the last year and a half, 2 years, we typically submit both an automated solution and a very manual solution. In Japan, customers don't typically want to sign contracts that are any longer than 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult for us to invest on the customer's behalf and take out the risk of getting paid back for those investments, that CapEx. So, you know, we'd like to see a 5 to 10 year commitment on the customer's part. And, you know, we're seeing those opportunities more and more now, at least customers that are saying, yes, we need to have an automated solution in the next 5 to 10 years. And I'm telling them that you need an automated solution now because it costs us more to find people to run your operation than it did, you know, 20 years ago. So at the same time, you know, the push towards sustainability is more and more important to our customers, in particularly the European customers. American customers still not as much. It's quite shocking, with the exception of like Patagonia, for example, you know, who make it part of their company culture to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we're really big on measuring our consumption of electricity and resources. And we actually have hard targets that we need to meet month to month, year to year, to achieve our goals by 2030. And so that's a challenge because, you know, we're in the process of educating a lot of our customers along with us, whether they want to. I'm also being critiqued in my performance on how we achieve those goals. So
yeah, the interesting part, automation and sustainability, I think are huge. I was at a Rakuten fulfillment center and watching all the automation that they're putting in, and it's incredible. And now it's become so much more sophisticated, so much quicker. What do companies need to do around automation to be able to be competitive, do you see in Japan?
Well, come talk to me because I can give you an idea of how to be competitive using that automation. But I think they just need to take a longer term view. It's for me, it's kind of mind boggling sometimes that businesses that have been operating in Japan for at least 30 years, some 50 years, that have very recognizable brands, that no, their business is really not going any place in Japan. Japan is a very stable market that I think you can plan in advance on what your year-to-year growth is going to be. Mm-hmm. It's a very stable market. It's not changing dramatically from one quarter to the next, or 1 year to the next, which, you know, for some people is maybe not as as good as other markets, but why not invest in the future of your business in Japan? Japanese consumers are still ranking in the top of consumers worldwide. So rather than committing to just 2 or 3 year terms, especially in your supply chain, is really work with a company like DSV that takes a longer term view to achieving, you know, cost control, cost containment, and cost reductions over time. And by collaborating, you know, we achieve those goals together. And that's not really just a sales pitch. That's if you're going to run your business, you know, thinking worst case scenario all the time, you're probably not going to be very successful, right? So, you know, take a longer term view. Your customers are taking a longer term view because they're Japanese, and Japanese customers do, or Japanese companies in general do. So, I mean, I can tell you that the really big brands that operate here are investing millions and millions of dollars in automation over the next 5 to 10 years. I've seen it. I can't talk about who they are, but Rakuten is an example. Amazon is another example. They're really trying to eliminate the human aspect, cost of their operation. And typically the ROI on those investments is 3 to 7 years. So it does make sense.
You know, we do a lot of work in transportation, and it's amazing how often I'm working with maybe APAC supply chain directors that are unaware of their partners, their 3PLs, 4PLs in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And oftentimes they've had a local head who has selected maybe a domestic provider because of price. And a lot of those choices are very short-sighted, and they, because a lot of the domestic companies aren't providing their clientele any of these solutions, which
yep.
You can see that when I'm speaking to these individuals, they don't realize what locally is really going on. And it behooves companies that are APAC leaders who are coming into Japan working here to really work with a partner that does realize what's going on and is looking long-term, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, local providers are good. They're very good for a lot of things. And typically when the APAC management team is looking at Japan, sometimes it's out of sight, out of mind. So as long as it works, we're good, you know. You know, the costs aren't incredibly expensive. Cost drivers, they can ask questions and they never get. I think, you know, we for the last, let's say, year and a half, 2 years, the RFQs that we're seeing, the opportunities that we're seeing, are really driven from either the global team or the regional team. And they are basically saying to us, we've used the same logistics provider in Japan for the last 10, 20 years, Japanese company, and they're doing the operation exactly the same way it's been done for 10, 20 years. There's really no collaboration. They're not giving us any opportunities to improve. You know, you talk about Kaizen all the time. That's primarily in the manufacturing industry. In Japan, the logistics industry really doesn't have a Kaizen process. Most companies, most of those 3PLs, just don't do a lot on the continuous improvement side. So that's a big part of our culture. And, you know, we're always looking to drive costs down and improve productivity. But they're also, like I said, they're looking to invest in automation. And they're really looking for that transparency and the opportunity to understand their operation better. And maybe even mimic or copy their operation in other countries. So the majority of our opportunities actually come from customers who are working with us, let's say in other parts of Asia, in Australia or India or Indonesia, and or in Europe or North America. And for the longest time, you know, Japanese companies and even Japanese logistics professionals will tell their regional offices, their head offices, well, you can't really do that in Japan. This is Japan, and it's different. So you have to operate this way. And yes, there are some structural differences, physical differences in the way the warehouses are structured. So you don't have extremely high ceilings. You know, 5.5 meters is kind of the standard. You know, trucks in general, you know, are different sizes. So there are some constraints, but in general, there's a lot of solutions that can be copy-pasted to this market. And working with a global supply chain company like DSV, we're able to point out where it can work and where there might need to be some adaptation to the local market. Believe it or not, there are still customers out there whose customers, the end customer, still uses fax machines.
Yeah.
So we have a fax machine in our warehouse because we have a customer that may require us to receive a fax. It's crazy. It's no place else in the world does it, but in Japan, they do.
Japan Automation is a fax machine.
Yeah. Yeah. We try to get them to change that as soon as possible.
One of the things, you know, noticed in over the years in Japan transportation is just the consolidation of companies. It's the same thing in a lot of industries. You see it in used to be the Big Eight consulting firms, and now it's Big Four. Mm-hmm.
You see it in our industry too.
So it's a lot of consolidation within supply chain. What do you see that? How do you see that changing for the transportation industry overall?
In Japan?
Yeah.
DSV wouldn't be who we are today if it wasn't for, you know, mergers and acquisitions. Consolidation is kind of a natural part of our business. You know, there's a lot of niche players in Japan. If anybody internationally is listening to this podcast, I can tell you a lot of private companies in Japan, a lot of niche players in Japan, very excellent niche players in Japan, whose, let's say, owners are the second generation, third generation owners, and they don't have anybody to take over the family business. And there's a lot of opportunity in Japan to do, you know, a roll-up of these niche players, whether it's on the trucking transportation side or on the warehousing and distribution side. You know, so you might have one company that handles medical devices, you know, or cosmetics, mm-hmm. or food products, fresh products. And so, you know, you can see that and it's happened over the last few years, especially with the larger Japanese 3PLs. SBS comes to mind. So does Hitachi Logistics, mm-hmm. which was bought by KKR about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Japanese companies or the logistics divisions of larger manufacturers. Shiseido Logistics was bought by Hitachi Logistics a few years back. So yeah, this is happening, and I think it's going to continue to happen and probably will accelerate because a lot of companies just can't manage the changes in the industry, the automation, as I mentioned, but also laws that are here to protect drivers in the trucking space. Our costs are being increased because you can't have drivers working over a certain number of hours per day or per month. So the smaller trucking companies are just basically giving up or being acquired by larger companies. So,
yeah, the people shortage is really pounding. Especially drivers, right? In Japan, it's such a big thing. And you've touched upon automation as far as a tool for helping to work on the recruitment side. So, but I'm always impressed with your hiring as an employer of choice, and you bringing DSV as an employer of choice. As a recruiter, I'm always impressed because you do a good job of employer branding. You could do a good job of recruiting without recruiters, and that's not. As a recruiter, I think it's a great thing. You should be doing the easy hires without recruiters, but you do. It's not simple, but you do a great job of it. So I'd love for you just to kind of chat a little bit more around how you position your company as a great company to work for.
Yeah, I mean, I try to obviously represent the company and the brand in a positive way. I'm trying to appeal to younger people, especially in the foreign international business community, that DSV exists. And we're not very big, you know. I've got a strong professional network in Tokyo that I let people know who I am and what I'm doing. And I'm always constantly, I guess, looking out for talent, not only leveraging people that I've worked with in the past, but people within that network or that group. I've actually, you know, hired a few individuals from two companies that I was working with in the past. And after those individuals have worked for me for 6 months or a year, then they've gone back to their previous employer, to their network and their friends or colleagues, and then recommended them to come to Japan and to come to DSV and work with us.
So you're exceptional at really bringing people in and being able to find people in a talent tight market. What are some of your secrets that you do to do that, Scott?
I think, you know, I'm always looking for talent, and I always kind of in the back of my mind thinking, you know, in the future when we have opportunities, would this individual be good to bring in? And I let them know that, you know, maybe we're not hiring now, but our business can be very unpredictable when it comes to resourcing and needing resources. You know, if we get a big project and it affects our growth in a positive way, you know, we might have to bring on talent in a matter of weeks or months. I mean, luckily, unluckily for you, I guess, is I've never been in a situation where I've needed to hire someone within, let's say, a limited amount of time, and it's been critical, business critical for us. Otherwise, I'd probably be reaching out to you more often. But I kind of, you know, plant these seeds with people or professionals that I know and saying, oh, okay, I met this guy a couple months ago. You know, he might be perfect for this role. You know, last month, I actually met two individuals who are very operational, who just reached out to me or reached out to one of our operations globally, and the person was put in touch with me in case, you know, an opportunity came along. And so I didn't have anything for them right now, but I said, you know, let's meet up for coffee, discuss, you know, where you are in your career and what you want in the next couple of years. And sometimes it's worked out. I've hired some individuals from a previous organization that I worked for, or two previous organizations, and they've come on and they've had a good experience working for DSV, and they've gone back to colleagues that they've worked in the past at their previous companies, and we've been able to recruit that way as well. Of course, we incentivize often introductions to people who have worked out in our organization. So if you introduce it, especially when it comes to blue collar, you know, less skilled workers, if they bring somebody from their previous employer and that person works out for that three month period, let's say, through probation, then we might give them an extra 50,000 yen or something as an incentive to introducing us to good people. And we found success in that past as well.
That's brilliant. I got a podcast I recorded earlier about how to recruit in Japan and difficult positions. And basically, you just summarized it. So thank you for that. See, If you're not listening to this podcast, you learn sales, you learn recruitment, because I coach so many managers, and one of the things they fail to do is create a recruitment bench. One of the main jobs as a manager is you should always be recruiting and meeting people, because if you're waiting for your HR, if you're waiting for your friendly headhunter focus core to come and bring you someone, it's not going to happen.
Right.
It's your responsibility as a manager to build your team. So I think I applaud the way you do it. I'm glad you guys incentivize people. And then you bring us in for hard to fill positions like your position. I mean, we introduced you to DSV, and that's what we should be doing. That's what recruiters need to be doing. Not for the easy to fill positions that managers should be doing.
Right.
Better.
These days, almost no position is easy to fill.
That's true.
And I think for your business in particularly, it's becoming more and more necessary for those difficult to find roles. I would say, especially when it comes to talent that is multicultural, if not Japanese, they at least understand what it means to work for perhaps a non-Japanese person or a non-Japanese person that can work in a Japanese organization or work for a Japanese person, right? And so it's not going to become easier, let's say, in the next 3 to 5 years, 10 years.
No.
So your industry and my industry are not going anyplace.
No, and I think your industry with the automation and what you're talking about, it's just so exciting. What do you think... because with the things that we've been talking about, you know, since you started working, we're kind of going into the future now. And how has your leadership style changed over the years with, you know, because now you're working with, you know, you were talking about mobile phones, we're talking about automation. There's just so many different components now compared to 35 years ago. How has your leadership style changed to keep up with that?
It hasn't. Let's put it this way: it hasn't stopped changing, and it has to continue to adapt and change, right? And that's been frustrating for me. And my wife is my biggest consultant partner because you know dealing with workplace issues now is very different than workplace issues 20, 30 years ago. You know, I have young people that are very sensitive and it's about their feelings. And I sound like I'm joking a little bit, tongue in cheek with that, but it is true.
Yeah.
And if I want to keep talented people, then I have to listen to where their concerns lie. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years ago when I started in this business, and I got a dirty look from an older colleague who might not like who I am, what I looked like, or how I behaved because I was not Japanese. You know, we grew thick skin and we just kept our head down and we dealt with it because we didn't think we could find another job as easily as perhaps young people can today. And so I've had to put those feelings and that experience aside and say, you know, What is it that you need from me so that you can do your job and not feel threatened or feel you need to be able to work in a safe place, right? Safe space. And as a 58-year-old white male, it's sometimes very difficult for me to have those conversations to myself. You know, how am I going to respond to this 26, 27, 28-year-old who has his feelings hurt or her feelings hurt, their feelings hurt. And having kids helps. Yeah. Having children, my own children are about that age, helps. But also having a wife, partner who is very, very receptive to those feelings, give me management advice in order for me to become a better person, but also a better manager. And it's not easy. Swallowing your pride practically on a daily, weekly basis, so you can become a better individual, is challenging. I'm not going to say it's not, but I do think that people in my team see that and they recognize that I am creating a stronger organization because of the steps that I take internally in order to retain the talent that we have, and recognize that, you know, people deal with these situations differently, and I've got their back. You know, I got my team's back, I got my management team's back, but I also have my our individual employees' backs. So
that's great. Well, you've given so many rich nuggets of wisdom today. Is there anything that I didn't ask or didn't know enough to ask that you want to share?
Podcasts that I've listened to that lately. Yeah. I try to stay on top of them, but you know, there's so much good material out there, right? I mean,
great material out there.
Even your organization produces, you personally produce a lot of great stuff. You know, Simon Sinek.
Yep.
I ran across one of his books, actually like a children's book, literally 10 years ago. Picked up copies for my kids. But he's one that's definitely, I try to, a little bit of optimism, I think, is his podcast. Gives both kind of management, but also your personal work that you do. And then most recently, actually through my nephew, got me on to Mark Manson.
Okay.
The Subtle Art of Not Giving a, you know what? Uh-huh. And he's got an interesting podcast. He's had some interesting people on his show also to give a little bit more perspective on, you know, entrepreneurialism, you know, not always making the decisions that are popular, but making decisions that I think help us individually become better in our lives, more comfortable in our own skin, and you know, hopefully being successful at the same time. So
that's great. But we'll put links to their shows in the show notes. Thanks for sharing those with us. So it's always good to find new podcasts and dive into the rabbit holes that they.
I came across, somebody told me about a history podcast, and this guy goes into the detailed history of Japan.
Oh, cool.
I haven't listened to it yet because I think it's like 4 hours long. I haven't started on it yet, but figure sometime this summer when I'm, you know, in the car for a long trip outside of Tokyo on the train. I hope to listen to part of those too, but thank you, David. Thank you for, you know, what you do for our community, our business community. And I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. And thank you for just sharing your wisdom. You've got so many, you're such a leader in the transportation industry in Japan, and very well respected. So I'm lucky to have an opportunity to, one, know you as, two, to have a chance to interview you today. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again. I'm doing the uptown slowdown, yeah.